Welcome back to Public Address Radio on Radio Live. PJ O'Rourke is an American writer and humorist who started out writing for National Lampoon and has ended up as a well-known Republican thinker. O'Rourke became a bestseller and one of the most quoted writers in the world for his take on politics, life and other human follies. He was in Auckland to deliver a lecture for Sydney-based think tank, the Centre for Independent Studies, and our lucky correspondent, Simon Pound, got to meet one of his idols.
First up, let's talk about your time at Rolling Stone, where you made your mark as a writer. What was it that you were doing for them?
Pretty much anything I wanted to. I had remarkable latitude. I was the foreign affairs desk chief and all of its Indians. I was, for most of the time that I was there, I was the sole foreign correspondent. Definitely from the middle 80s to the late 90s. And it was just wonderful. I just bounced around the world, going from one hellhole to another and making fun of everything.
What kind of places did you go to? You covered a lot of wars, didn't you?
Did. Bosnia a couple times. Lebanon a couple of times. El Salvador, Nicaragua, the Gulf in 91, and again in 2003. Overthrow of Marcos in the Philippines, handover of Hong Kong to the Chinese, fall of the Berlin Wall. Got there. I wasn't there for the very moment, alas, but I managed to get there that weekend and fell on a midnight on Thursday night, and I got there by that weekend. So I was still able to go to the party.
They're remarkable events that kind of charted the change in the world from the bipolar world to the kind of the world we live in now. I mean, what latitude did you have in the way that you covered these events?
I had no instructions. It was strictly up to me. It was really an ideal job. It's easy enough to get the freedom to do this sort of thing, but usually that freedom leaves you without the money to do that sort of thing. It is maybe slightly harder to get the money to do these things, but it is very hard to get any freedom once you've got the money. So I was able to go places like South Africa and Tanzania. I just went to Tanzania on the sort of drop of a hat. I just decided it might be interesting to see what's going on in Tanzania. And went on a one-man safari in Tanzania, all at Rolling Stone's expense. Did the same thing with Bangladesh. I was just interested in Bangladesh was so terribly overpopulated and deprived, and then I discovered that it had the same population density as a little suburb of San Francisco, a pleasant little middle-class suburb of San Francisco. And I thought, let's go to both of those places. And so off I went. So it was a tremendous benefit. And it's one of those opportunities that I don't think will pass this way again. The print media isn't rich enough to do this kind of thing anymore. The televised media can do these sorts of things, but you know how it is. We're looking at it right here. When you haul around a bunch of cameras, the journalists back in the day used to call television cameras part of the body I shan't mention, magnet. You could stand around with a notebook all day and nobody took much notice of you. If you got out a still camera, you'd attract some people. If you got out a video camera, hordes would descend upon you and you could end up altering events.
Let's talk about the mixture of things that you brought to the role as well, coming from a comedy writing background. How did you have that inform what you did? And was there anyone writing like you did at that time?
It wasn't my idea, is all I can really say. I haven't been a comedy writer exactly, but I've been writing humorous pieces for the for National Lampoon for a long time, for a decade. And I had been a first managing editor and then editor-in-chief at the Lampoon. So I knew my trade fairly well. And it was Michael Kinsley who would go on to found Slate. This is 1982. He was then editor of Harper's. Michael called me out of the blue. I think we knew each other to say hi. And he asked me, would I be willing to go on a cruise up the Volga, up the Don and Volga rivers in the Soviet Union for Harper's Magazine? And I jumped at the chance, and I wasn't long into that enterprise before I realized that that the world was full of much funnier things than I could ever make up, and all I had to do was stand around and watch them.
Was the funnier things was that the friendship of the Russia-America club, was it?
Well, that certainly was part of it. I mean, going along on a tour of old Soviet Russia back at the end of the Brezhnev era with a bunch of American leftists who were all trying to put the best face on things was pretty hilarious. But there were also just moments of pure human comedy mixed in with the idiotic politics. We're going through the Don Volga Canal, and there was this old left-wing lady, one of these total chatterboxes. And she and I are standing by the rail as we're going through this lock, this concrete lock, just big walls of concrete. And she's nattering away, and she's going, "Oh, the Soviets are such marvelous engineers. Look at this, you know, look at this incredible ship lock that they've built. They're such great engineers." And I'm going, it's a lot of concrete. She's going on and on. And then she peeks over the side of the ship, and she goes, "And where do they get all the water?" Where indeed.
That's remarkable. Yeah. The writing you did that brought humor and personal perspective to events that previously may have been treated in a very dry way, was that new?
I don't think it was new. I mean, I think that Mark Twain was doing that in his Innocents Abroad 100 years before me. I don't think there was much of it going on at that time. There was a tendency to treat great events with the deep and serious and earnest tone that great events require, which is nonsense. I mean, great events like small events happen to ordinary people. And I always felt that my job in covering these events, great and small, was be the representative of the ordinary person, to get the worm's eye view on this. I always stayed away from interviewing important people on the basis that they didn't get to be important by being stupid enough to tell the truth to some random reporter who wandered in off the street. The role of journalist as a skeptical observer was predominant when journalism was a trade, which is what journalism properly is. Now that it has become a profession, not to say art form, a great deal of baloney has crept into the system. I mean, well, I'm old enough that when I first got into journalism, it was a blue-collar trade. If you grew up in a blue-collar neighborhood and you didn't want to get up early in the morning and lift heavy things, and you liked books, you had two choices. You could go into the church, or you could go into journalism. And you'd weigh these things and you'd think, you know, whiskey, women. Which will it be? And how about whiskey and women? We have that with and free hockey tickets, you know? And so the newsrooms of the world were populated by regular guys. A few of them had been to college, many had not. And I mean, they were guys, of course, in those days predominantly. And it was a matey environment. It was a take the piss out of them environment. It was a skeptical environment. And I think it was pretty good at reporting the world. Then, sometime in the 50s and 60s and so on, with the rise of journalism school, and then probably the worst thing that ever happened to journalism was the movie All the President's Men, about how Woodward and Bernstein saved the nation from this vicious thug, Richard Nixon. And so journalism began to be defined as speaking truth to power. Well, no. I mean, we might occasionally speak facts to the public if we're very good. Truth to power, indeed.
And what about the rise of journalism as being part of a 24-hour entertainment product? Does that have an impact on its ability to be skeptical?
Well, it's interesting to me that the 24-hour news cycle has opened up a tremendous amount of time to fill. And if you sit and watch it for, say, 4 or 5 hours, you'll see just how they've managed to make very little content fill all that time. instead of the 24-hour news cycle opening us up to all sorts of much more interesting stories that we might not have known, I mean, what's going on with the government of Sierra Leone now? I mean, they had their horrible civil war, and they presumably have constructed some kind of peace in Sierra Leone and in Liberia. But you could watch 24-hour news cycle for 24 hours and never hear that mentioned at all. Instead, you'll come back, it'll be swine flu, swine flu, swine flu, swine flu, Mel Gibson divorce, swine flu, swine flu. Yeah, it's amazing. You know, there's always been a tendency of journalism to sink towards trashiness, and there's always been an entertainment element to journalism. After all, why do we really need to know about this fire or that car wreck? There's always been that side of it. But it seems that between the electronic media and the visual media, and maybe just my old age and crankiness, we seem to be, you know, leaning much more in that direction. Yeah. But if I'd seen, if I had foreseen opinion journalism being so much of a driving force, I think I might have been tempted to keep my opinions to myself. One thing I've always admired about Tom Wolfe is that he does keep his opinions to himself. You are able to intuit and to deduce what some of his opinions are about some things, but by and large, he plays it very close to his chest about what his opinions are.
Yeah, I think your style liberated a lot of people to do that.
Alas. You're very welcome.
Thank you very much for your time. It's wonderful talking to you.
That's Simon Pound talking to PJ O'Rourke. Coming up after the break, we talk to Irish comedian Ed Byrne.